And welcome back. And we have an interview today that I'm really excited about. We've been talking about it for a while. It is with Toby Manning. Toby, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good. And just to give a bit of background how this came across, Toby emailed in, because we love to talk about books on our Twitch, and we love to talk about interesting books. And I got an email from Toby. It was like, I'd like to come on the radio and talk about my book. And I saw the title of the book, which is Mixing Pop and Politics, A Marxist History of Popular Music. And I thought, well, that's a fascinating title. That sounds like just the kind of thing. And so about 4 months later, here we are. But Toby, thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure. Glad to be here.
So the most important thing, I was just saying this before, well, maybe not the most important thing, but an important distinction. You say this book is a Marxist history of popular music, not a history of Marxist popular music, right?
Yeah.
So what exactly is a Marxist history of popular music?
Okay, so the point I'm making there is I'm trying to distinguish what I'm doing from just an account of protest songs, right? So there are books already about that. There's Dorian Lenski's 33 and a Third, Revolutions Per Minute. There's Daniel Tracy's Walls Come Tumbling Down. So that's kind of already been covered. And I thought it was more interesting and kind of fun, in a way, to try and understand the ways in which politics, in the broader sense, informs, in often in quite subtle ways, just ordinary songs. And they might be a love song. It might be an instrumental. It might be something that you would have never, ever connected to politics. And my sort of challenge to myself was, can I find ways in which these often innocuous seeming songs somehow reflect what's going on in the world around them, even if they don't directly address it?
Give us an example of a song people wouldn't expect to find in your book.
I guess maybe Katy Perry's Firework. Right. Oh. Because I'm at that point, in the immediate aftermath of the financial crash, there's a ton of songs about however awful things get, you will find a way through. You know, you will find a sort of resilience to get through this disaster in these tough times. It's just full of it. I mean, in a way you can say Black Eyed Peas, I Got a Feeling, it's another one as well. You know, just like these songs about let's go out and have a good time and party and forget the sort of the lousiness of everyday life. And it struck me as there's no coincidence. This all happens after the crash, you know?
I wanted to say, you work across journalism and academia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit about yourself. Like, what is your background? How did you enter this sort of very interesting interesting kind of crossover? Because your previous books, one was A Rough Guide to Pink Floyd, and one was John le Carré and the Cold War, which seemed quite different. How did you come up with the idea of writing about Marxism and pop?
Well, I've worked as a journalist for a long time, you know, sort of across popular culture, I suppose. That's the link. But I ended up specializing quite a lot in music, and I worked for all the big British music titles in the 90s and noughts for a while. Then I sort of went off and sort of studied for a PhD and sort of got myself up to speed on Marxist theory. And then it's just like, then I just put it all together, I suppose. It's just like, I now feel like I have a sort of, where before in journalism, I just talked about people's biographies and, you know, what their music sounded like or what their book was about. Now I try and understand it sort of contextually and historically and, you know, sort of put it into that sort of grid that I've got of sort of understanding the world.
Because there's no one else that I can really think of that's writing about this subject, right?
No, I like to think I'm unique.
So one of the things about the sort of blurb around the book, which I appreciate you might not have written yourself, but it calls the book, it says it's provocative. In what way would you say that is the book is provocative?
I mean, I did write the blurb myself. As a writer these days, I don't think yourself. It's provocative because, well, I mean, one reason is, well, because people get really provoked by the idea of Marxism. Let's not mince words here, you know. If you say you're a Marxist, I mean, a lot of people, when I first told people the title of the book, a lot of people's immediate response was to laugh. So, which I thought was very interesting. So I think, like, you know, because, and that sort of highlights my view that a lot of people think that politics and popular music don't mix, that they're in separate categories. So that's one thing. But yeah, I think we're in a time where sort of Marxism is regarded as either irrelevant or extreme or whatever, you know, or perhaps on a, just on a level of reading that it's sort of very dry and sort of dusty. And I'm really try hard to make it, I mean, I don't know whether I succeed, I try hard to make it kind of quite accessible and just relevant to people's lives, you know.
I've got to say, I've not read all the book. I've read about 40 pages, so which isn't a great deal, but I've been really enjoying it. So I think right. you have done that. Why are people so afraid of Marxism?
I mean, Marxism as there's two forms of Marxism, right? So are you saying that they're, are we talking about whether they're afraid of Marxism as a sort of political system or whether they're afraid of Marxism as a sort of, as a philosophy?
I mean, almost just the word, if you see what I mean. Like, I think, you know, okay, I mean, I'll explain myself a little bit further. I think that, most musicians wouldn't like being referred to in some way with Marxism, right?
What about Stereolab? They've always been...
Well, we talked about it. Sorry, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. So there are some instances, you know, there are some instances. Stereolab would be quite happy with that. The Clash would have been quite happy with that. I'd imagine Public Enemy would be reasonably happy with that. There was a less successful band on the fringes of the charts called the Redskins in the 80s who were very happy with the idea of being Marxist. You know, there have been people like Crass who were like maybe more anarchist and had minor hits. So there are people
Chumbawamba.
Who would,
yeah. Weren't Chumbawamba kind of proudly?
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's another really good example. Yeah. And all of, but you know, despite my saying like, you know, the books about protest songs have already been written, I cover all of these things. I'm not going to leave them out. You know, they're crucial and they're exciting songs and they're kind of like, you know, they're proper kind of refusals of the system. But yeah, most people would probably want to distance themselves from Marxism. But, you know, I'm making no claim that anybody who doesn't say they're Marxist is Marxist. I'm just using a Marxist lens to understand what they're doing. So I try hard not to make any too outlandish claims. I just sort of say, when you could see this as having some you know, some relevance to this. And, you know, my big get out there is I think a lot of people aren't doing it consciously. You know, it's like we're all products of the society we live in. And everything from our vocabulary to the way we dress to a lot of times the things we like or don't like, they're informed by sort of social currents and social trends and all the rest of it. We all like to think we're completely unique and unaffected by these things, but we're not, you know.
Well, one particular example you give early on in the book, which I'd never thought about before, but you talk about ABBA's Waterloo, which says the history book on the shelf is always repeating itself, which is a sort of Marxist reference, right? Well, loose quotation from Marx, you put it.
Yeah, I mean, Marx said that history repeats itself. The first time was tragedy, the second time is farce, right? So it's like that whenever anybody uses a phrase that's similar, they are, whether they know it or not, quoting Marx. Obviously, and the other thing, interesting thing about Waterloo, of course, is it is actually an example of a song that uses, you know, political or historical language to, you know, in the form of a love song. And whenever that happens, it's always slightly weird. It always makes me think, oh, what's going on here? You know? Yeah, so, you know, and that happens a lot. You know, there are waves of these things where just people use weird language to do something like, you know, to declare their love. And like, so for instance, in the 80s, it's just full of this really kind of businessy, transactional language that, you know, like Tina Turner was saying, like, you know, I always want to inspect the goods before I buy and stuff like that, you know.
So Johan mentioned it earlier, and I know we've talked about this by email, which is Stereolab, who are a very interesting example of a band that I love, who they say they are not Marxists. They say they have not read Marx, although they are often considered a Marxist band. Where do you stand on that?
I mean, I have to say, I don't believe them on that, you know, I mean, and we could all say that, you know, depends how we want to define it. I could say I haven't read Marx because, you know, I'm probably not going to get through the whole of Das Kapital before I die. Do you know what I mean? But I've read it in sections. So, yeah, I think they're being a little bit disingenuous there. I mean, you never know. So, well, you know, maybe people's political affiliations change over time. So maybe they're wanting to reassess what their image is sort of later on, you know. So I'm never entirely trustworthy of what artists say about their own music, you know.
So this, I'm not going to claim any great understanding of Marxism. So what I'm about to say might be really stupid. But anyway, it kind of struck me that isn't the whole music business capitalist at its core? It's all about selling stuff. It's all about... So how do you see that kind of interacting with Marxism? Mm.
That's absolutely not stupid. It's the central, you know, the central concept and core of what I'm doing. So, yeah. There was a long time when sort of purist Marxists would sneer at popular music, right? Precisely for what the reasons that you're saying. And a lot of them still do. You know, this is a capitalist industry. All it's ever going to do is either produce sort of pacifying slop to keep the masses down and in their place. Or if it's more than that, it's going to be ideology basically telling them how great capitalism is and how the system of liberal democracy cannot be improved upon. One way or another, you know. And there's some truth in that. There are songs which are capitalistic, you know, Madonna's Material Girl, or, you know, even Nas's Hate Me Now, you know. What I think is really interesting is the fact that even in a sort of consumer-orientated industry, so let's take it back to the sort of beginnings of sort of consumer capitalism and sort of pop and the sort of advent of the teenager in the 50s, right? So what happened then was a sort of weird interface between something that bubbles up from the street, right, and from the margins, from black communities, from poor white communities and stuff, on little indie labels and crappy little sort of provincial recording studios, takes the record industry, who just wants to pump out bland ballads, completely by surprise. But obviously, because they're a capitalist industry, they want to go where they want to follow the money. Right, so they can have a go at trying to sort of quash these things, but really, if they're going to follow the money, they're going to have to sort of bring these things in house, maybe sand off their edges a little bit, maybe try and tame them a little bit, make them a bit more family orientated. And what I feel is really interesting is that the struggle that then ensues, and you see the same thing later on with, I don't know, the British invasion with the Beatles. There's this endless struggle as the corporations try to sort of tame and compress these sort of, you know, these sort of explosive energies. But there's something about that meeting that produces something incredible. The attempt from one side to control something, the other side to sort of come up with this sort of raw explosion of talent. You know, the meeting produces something incredibly amazing. And all the time there are these glimpses of, therefore, coming into the mainstream of what life could be like, of a sort of utopian vision of life, of freedom, of, you know, in all sorts of ways. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. Well, it kind of made me think, like, can you think, are there any, and apologies if this is in the book, but I haven't got to yet, but can you think of any like popular bands, musicians who run their organization in a way that might be considered kind of closer to sort of Marxist principles? I mean, Johan mentioned Chumbawamba earlier. I don't really know the ins and outs of how they did it, but I imagine they might be idea. There was some sort of, there were some punk bands in the 70s maybe. But yeah, is there anyone today you can think of that
even like the bands from the Washington hardcore scene and stuff like Fugazi, you know, would they be, or Shellac even? Toby, what would you say?
I think there are, you know, and yeah, you're exactly, you're homing there in on the sort of the DIY post-punk kind of hardcore or indie scene or whatever. And there've been repeated attempts to try and sort of have some sort of greater autonomy from the sort of, you know, the relentless machine of the major labels and stuff, you know. And sometimes those are quite successful, you know, but the process tends to be that they get gobbled up. You know, either the band eventually signs to a major because they think that they can get more diffusion that way, and it's true, you know, or the indie label that they've set up gets gobbled up by a maester. You know, it's very hard to resist those offers when you're running a sort of rickety, insecure operation. I don't know. Right now, I mean, there are always things coming up on indie labels. There are always people who are kind of, you know, doing stuff like organizing their own tours and stuff like that, you know, who are taking these things in hand and run things from their websites and stuff, you know. And then there's at the moment, there's this guy called DJ AG. I don't know if you've heard of him. He just goes out on the street in Brixton with a set.
Oh, yes. I've seen a video. Yes.
And he DJs on the street with no permit.
Yeah, he DJs on the street with no permit, and basically, and people, anybody can come up basically and like MC over his beats, and he's become this phenomenon. So some quite big grime MCs have turned up and kind of like, you know, and sort of rapped over his beats and stuff. So, you know, and he's just completely outside of the record industry. It's just again, you know, but I mean, everything starts outside the record industry. It's just like, how do you kind of maintain that autonomy once the wheels get you know, start rolling, you know?
Because many of these bands like use the thing of, no, you've got to attack the system from within. You know, yes, you've got to play the game and butter and kiss the babies, no, as they say. But not the ideal metaphor, especially in the music industry. Anyway, sorry. But can you think of an example of a band or a genre, a movement that successfully managed to kind of detonate the system from within, or do they end up like Rage Against the Machine accepting the $1 million check to play Coachella sponsored by a person who
I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to think. I mean, a lot of people felt like The Clash sold out because they did sign to a major and everything, didn't they? So, but you know, but it seems to me like their politics remained the same pretty much, you know, so I kind of feel like that is possible. I mean, I actually think not a bad example in some ways, though obviously it didn't work out well, as Nirvana, you know, because they signed to a major, they take on in some ways all the corporate trappings, but you know, so I mean, like for instance, Smells Like Teen Spirit is incredibly corporately produced. It's got like drum samples and all the rest of it. So, but it's an absolute howl of fury at the entire system. And, you know, the video has what looks like a kind of like, you know, beginnings of a revolution almost occurring, you know. And it's just like, and then that continues, you know. Then the follow-up is like they use Steve Albini as a producer, go for a really raw kind of punky in-your-face sound. So there's never really, you know, within the confines of a major system, I mean, my feeling is that Kurt Cobain probably paid for this with his life.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, I kind of feel like they got that kind of, you know, very anti-establishment message, anti-corporate message out in the heart of this sort of corporate rock behemoth, you know.
But their T-shirts are selling in fast fashion, you know, big chains, isn't it? And because, you know, his daughter and Courtney Love have sold over the rights for the Nirvana logo. So it's kind of like the machine ends up winning. If I don't want to be too hopeless about it. Sergio on the ear was saying Godspeed You Black Emperor would be a good example of you know, a band that's ferociously independent. You know, they've got Constellation Records. They even gave us flack at Primavera Sound because they performed a year when they installed the fingerprint. To access the venue, you had to put your fingerprint on a machine, and they were totally like livid with it. It's like, oh, you know, we love this fest. We thought we loved this festival, but now they're like taking your data. Don't stand for it and stuff. Yeah, it's like, hey. Sorry, Ben.
So no, I want. I'm sorry. Go on, please.
Just to come back to Godspeed specifically. I mean, the thing is, they don't really chart, right? I mean, so the thing, like, and that's in part probably because they don't play the game, but it's also in part because their music is not overtly commercial as well. So it's like it's deliberately kind of abstract and you know, relatively challenging. So that's the thing. You know, if you can you insert yourself into the mainstream? Can you get into the chart while still being challenging? And there are occasions when that happens. I mean, there's something like Laurie Anderson's Oh Superman, which is like a massive hit in the UK in the 80s. It nearly went to number one, you know, or even just God Save the Queen, you know, a couple of years before that. These things do happen, but yeah, it's harder. And just to answer your other question, the machine does always win, you know, but that isn't actually negative to me, because that's why I see music as a kind of like metaphor for kind of the class struggle for the fortunes of ordinary people. Because however much the machine will win, the corporations will win one way or another, something new will bubble up. You know, that particular battle will be lost. Yeah, so let's say the Nirvana battle has been lost, you know, and just been sold over to the corporations. But there are new bands and new acts and new artists coming up and new genres, you know, percolating all the time. That, you know, the record companies didn't create, they didn't ask for them, they don't want them, but they have to deal with them once they become a thing.
One very interesting thing in your book is chapter 11, Pop It Like It's Hot, good title, posits that pop and politics' imperial phase was 2001 to 2007, which I think if you ask most people, pop and politics, when do they most mix? They'd probably say, I don't know, the 60s or the late 70s or something like that. Mm. Why was this pop and politics' imperial phase from 2001 to 2007?
Okay, well, I'm kind of playing on words there because... there's, I think it dates back to Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys, the phrase imperial phase, right? Mm. Which I think is really unfortunate. You know, so you refer to somebody's like glory days of like when they kind of rule the world, I suppose, commercially, as their imperial phase. I don't think that's something that, you know, that people on the left who are interested in popular music should kind of be using as a phrase. Hey, imperialism's great, you know?
So very, I've never thought about it. It's a very good point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm being a bit kind of pedantic in that respect.
But it is a good point. It is a very good point, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, as a way of explaining your kind of success, it just seems unfortunate. So I'm talking about the fact that, so when I say imperial phase, I don't mean it's necessarily a good thing.
Right.
And what I'm doing is talking about the fact that at that point, the concept of pop as a genre, as quite a relatively rigidly defined genre, rather than just meaning all of popular music, became dominant. And there was this, and won out against all other genres. You know, sort of indie rock was killed off. You know, metal, new metal was like certainly kind of pushed to the background, and so on and so forth. So there was this all dominance pop, which just so happened to coincide with the Iraq War, which is to me is a massive adventure in imperialism. So I'm just making a play on these two things sort of occurring simultaneously.
Okay.
But it's funny because if you think of especially hip hop in the early 2000s, that's when you get all your 50 cents and all, and it's all about the bottle of the bub, you know, the Lexus. They're all like sort of living the American dream. I finally made it. I've got my stacks. I've got my house in the suburbs. And all of a sudden, all those voices in the 90s who were talking about how hard it was in the ghetto and Wu-Tang Clan, Staten Island, growing up, having to sell drugs as a, you know, the thing shifts. Do you think American hip hop is would you say it's the most tragic example of something that began, as you mentioned earlier, you know, in the streets, and it was the voice of people who were completely, you know, that didn't have a voice in mainstream media, you know, the black community. And all of a sudden, was it the machine who poisoned them into take the gifts? Or was it just inevitable that, you know, if you come from a class struggle and all of a sudden you make it, you're just going to end up loving the fur coat?
I mean, there's a very long answer to that because we're talking a long timeline there, right? But I mean, one of the things I do talk about is like, you know, self-incorporation, you know, that sometimes people just, you know, they haven't necessarily been pressured to sell out. They just, you know, did choose to do so for whatever reason. So that shouldn't be left out. But yeah, I kind of feel like hip hop's gone in cycles, and that's what's really interesting. So, you know, it comes up from the street, you know, it's a completely autonomously invented new music, you know, very, very creative with very limited, tools in, you know, early hip hop and stuff. And then, what you're talking about really, I guess, is the way that gangster rap sort of shifts over, you know, sort of via what was termed bling hip hop for a while, and then just becomes a sort of pop hip hop, which is just a sort of celebration of nearly all of whom of these people have their roots in sort of gang culture or gangster rap. And Jay-Z would be the famous example, right? And but yeah, 50 Cent is totally another. And they just end up sort of increasingly sort of celebrating their sort of wealth and their power and occasionally their skills and stuff like that, and getting involved in big beefs with other people with sort of a huge audience and stuff. So And then it seems to me that something even worse happened within that is that the sort of a combination of this pop domination seemed to like really seep into hip hop. And so hip hop started to use EDM beats. People stopped rapping and started singing and stuff. And so hip hop was in just the most lamentably corporate sort of state by about, 2010 or something. And then it all bubbles up again. There's nothing more glorious to me than the sort of rise of Kendrick Lamar. And he's not alone in that. There's just like and trap as well was something else that nobody was sort of unlicensed, It was like kind of scary to record corporations and stuff, like, another form of kind of, criminal kind of music that kind of like, answer to no one and just sort of bubbles up from the street and just is really radical. And again, you see trap gradually becoming more corporate now, People will argue that Kendrick has. I'm not actually convinced that he has. I think Kendrick stayed pretty true to what he's about, but
Okay, we sort of mentioned this a little bit earlier, but like there are people who say pop and politics don't mix. I'm sure people have said that to you in the past. What is your reaction?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of think like as politics affects everything in some level or another, I just don't see why it wouldn't affect popular music. So it's like this notion, it seems like, do we apply it to the idea that art is immune from politics any other area? Apart from popular music. So, and it seems to me also just a version of the notion, it's a version of that sort of downgrading of music as well, that it's somehow, it's just escapist,
It has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. Thank you so much for coming. Glad we could make it happen. The book is called Mixing Pop and Politics, A Marxist History of Popular Music, available from all your usual places.
Is it available in Spain? Has it been translated?
No,
it hasn't been translated yet. I hope it will be.
Yeah, yeah. If anyone wants to translate, I'm sure you get in touch. But no, you can obviously buy it through online basically. Toby, thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure. And
fantastic.
I hope everything goes very well with the book, which has been out for a few months, I know. But I hope everything is going very well with the book.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ed.
Have a nice day.
Bye.
Bye.